As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, schools reopening special. Spurs enjoy their new class, but Liverpool still getting schooled at home. And City suddenly out of form too. We take a comprehensive look at the weekend's action, top to bottom, look ahead to Leipzig and discuss footballing terms in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hi, listener. Monday the 8th of March. Thank you for joining us on board Totally today. We've got Michael Cox of ZonalMarking.net. Hello, Michael.
Hi, James.
The Sunday night Solomon Daniel story is here with us.
Evening, James.
Good evening to you. And the Marshall McLuhan, can I say, of football broadcasting, Adam Hurry.
Hello.
A.K.A. Football Clichés. Thank you for joining us, Adam.
Thank you very much.
You're here to police our use of the kind of the lexicon.
Yes, that's increasingly my role, I think.
Right, good. And it's an evolving role, of course, because of the times that we live in. Now you've got a whole subcategory about nothing without the fans, we want them back as soon as possible, etc.
Well, yeah, I have a huge fatigue when it comes to that. I'm starting to think that maybe we should just ignore it now.
Right.
We assume that everybody now knows about the times we live in.
What about the description of the taking the knee? Because that's become a little bit of a sub-genre as well.
Well, I feel quite uncomfortable even passing comments on it because, you know, it's something they have to say at the start of every game, but they've run out of ways of saying it. And and not only that, they've run out of ways of apologising for swearing to the point where Bill Leslie on Sky the other night just simply said, oh, I suppose it's now time for us to apologise for swearing. And it sounded like he was really, really sick of the whole thing. So, we've hit a real kind of impasse with all sorts of things, I think.
Among the many positives of there being no fans in stadiums, the fact that you can hear the naughty bits is obviously huge. But I wondered if anyone else could back me up on this, but I've really been enjoying Match of the Day of late. I know that everyone loved the screaming bit at the end of Saturday's one, but just in general, I'm not sure if they've got a new producer in, or is it because it's a shorter duration or something? But they just seem to be much more relaxed and having fun, Gary and the...
It feels quite a last day of school atmosphere, doesn't it? Sort of D-mob happy atmosphere in the studio. Yeah, I don't know why that is. It must be deliberate because it hasn't noticeably shifted. Maybe it's because the football is not as entertaining as maybe it was and it's quite relentless that they feel like they need to bring a bit of je ne sais quoi into it.
Mm. I think as well, sometimes it's probably quite exhausting for them if they have to be across like 8 games in a day. And so maybe there's only 4. A bit more relaxed. So having said that, prepare for our analysis of 8 games over the weekend.
Yeah. Well, although you've already requested that we don't talk about 2 of them. So we'll see. By the way, on the subject of getting the fans back in, The Athletic, among the many top football sites, reporting that the Premier League is looking at shifting round 36 and round 37 of the season back so that they'll occur after the restrictions on fans attending events have lifted so that they could get up to 10,000 supporters in for games. This has not been ratified by the Premier League. There's no official confirmation, but the idea is out there. The season would still end on the 23rd of May. And we'll keep across that one. All right, let's talk some football. What happened this weekend? Man City's 21-game winning run came to a sudden end against neighbours Man United. Bruno Fernandes converting a penalty given just 34 seconds in. Luke Shaw adding United second. United thus stay second in the table, 11 points behind City. They're a point ahead of Leicester, whose 2-1 win at Brighton, coupled with Fulham's win at Liverpool, means the Seagulls are now just goal difference ahead of the Cottagers in the relegation scrap. Elsewhere, Sunday was the worst night for Palace all year, at least until Monday, as Spurs ran out 4-1 winners over Roy Hodgson's side. Arsenal, who Spurs face next week, were peak gunners in their 1-1 draw at Burnley. We'll talk about that shortly. Saints ended their losing streak with a 2-0 win at Sheffield United and Villa and Wolves. And West Brom and Newcastle shared goalless draws. The latter, a fixture straight from one of Dante's circle, a spectacle that was, in many ways, Nietzsche's abyss staring into you. Where do you want to start? Manchester Derby.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
The Derby and Shaw scores! Goodness me, it's Luke Shaw for Manchester United. Well, they started the first half in electrifying fashion. And this isn't far behind.
Manchester Derby, 2-0 Man United. Why does Solskjaer always win this game?
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? I mean, I think since he took over at Manchester United, his tactics in big games have usually been pretty good. I don't think the results so far this season have necessarily shown that. But I thought not only was his game plan spot on, but I thought his analysis after the game where he said, actually, it was a pretty similar game to last weekend against Chelsea. The only difference was a penalty decision. I thought that actually worked quite well. I mean, I do think this Manchester United side is geared towards playing on the break, as you know, as we all know, especially when Daniel James is in the side to go with Rashford and Martial, who I think probably had his best game of the season. And I think on this particular occasion, Solskjaer used quite a clever strategy, I thought, where Fred and McTominay were very wide, very far apart from each other, which is pretty unconventional, protecting the space in the channels, which City usually work really well with De Bruyne and Gundogan. And then the three in front, Rashford and Fernandes and James, just blocked the centre really well. So I think in terms of specifics, I think that's what they did in this game. In terms of why it's always this game, I don't quite know, but I do think that there's something about Solskjaer's coaching that does make him suited to playing as the underdog, really. And it's the games like Crystal Palace and midweek where I still think they are, despite the results in that sense improving this season, I still find them quite unconvincing against those weaker sides.
Mm. Daniel, you certainly saw this one coming.
Yeah, well, in terms of, firstly, as Michael says, about kind of what Solskjaer's good at, and also in this kind of driven narrative terms that he seems to, just when you're losing faith, i.e. Palace in midweek, he kind of reels you back in and maybe even reels some Manchester United supporters. I don't know if fans now do fluctuate between camps or if that tribalism so entrenched that they've picked their opinion and they're sticking to it. But I wouldn't know what to think as a Manchester United fan, because it is a good result, but it's a result that comes 3 weeks after Solskjaer gave up the title and, you know, 3 months after they were top of the league. So it's really hard to know where to fall on that. But yeah, I mean, personally, I would still be deeply annoyed if I was a United fan that this ultimately probably doesn't mean that much. Because, you know, if they had beaten Palace and Sheffield United and West Brom, there'd be a point off top now and everyone would be saying, well, they can win the league, and I don't think they can, which is a shame for the title race and also a shame for Solskjaer, because you don't know when another, you know, you don't know if other sides will be as bad next year. Chelsea might improve again. Liverpool might come back. It's not as easy as saying we'll improve again next year and we'll get closer. This felt like a really good opportunity.
Right. I mean, it's entirely valid what you say about them not doing this in those other games, but they are essentially the closest competitor to a City team that has been, at least until this weekend, on an extraordinary run of form. They hadn't famously been behind for a single minute in any of their previous 19 Premier League matches. That all, of course, changed a couple of minutes into this one with the penalty that was awarded against City for Gabriel Jesus' agricultural challenge. Keshav Rampal, among the many people writing in on the subject of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, asking, will he still be there in 26 years' time with two FA Cups and a Community Shield? It's a chilling prospect, isn't it? What did you make of City's reaction? Or was Was there a City reaction?
To me, that, I mean, they created chance in the last 20 minutes. I thought they improved probably because Foden came on with kind of quick feet and also because United naturally sat deep. But the big issue with City has always been when they concede first, they don't win. They've conceded first in 16 games since the start of last season in the Premier League, and they've only won three of them, which is far fewer than lots of other sides around them. And it will annoy Guardiola because that's the type of performance out of nowhere that City have produced in the Champions League, and that's probably their big, you know, that's their big mountain to climb this season is the Champions League.
I'd also say that the two goals that they conceded were probably goals I might well have scripted beforehand. First of all, the penalty. And given how much thought that Guardiola must put into his game plan, to even allow the possibility that after 34 seconds, a striker would be making a challenge like that on the edge of a penalty area. It really does confuse me that these sort of things are allowed to happen. You know, that a striker would be instructed just to not be anywhere near that situation. Go away. It was the absolute textbook example of a striker's challenge. It was such a weird thing for anybody to be doing, let alone in the nascent stages of a very, very big game.
Absolutely.
And then the second goal was, it was barely a counter-attack. It came from Henderson throwing the ball out really, really nicely. You don't see a throw like that. It's a pinpoint throw, not in a huge rush to do it. And then Shaw kind of just barreling forward, which is the apt phrase because that's exactly what he looks like. And then kind of finishing in it in a way that I've never seen a fullback score like that in my life. It was a really, really nice finish, like really kind of premeditated. I'm putting it here and you're not going to save it. Kind of sort of slightly messy-like, which was, feels very strange to say. So two goals in the grand scheme of things, I would actually expect City to have conceded.
Right. Oh, that's good. Luke Shaw, by the way, while we're throwing Ole Gunnar Solskjaer some love, is he a player who Solskjaer has improved, or at least has improved under Solskjaer, which has been one of the charges maybe brought against Ole in the past? Does he make players better the way that Pep does?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know to what extent Solskjaer's responsible for his improvement, but yes, I think he's had a very good season. I think aside from Fernandes, who I think has probably been the best player in the league, Shaw's probably been Manchester United's next best player this year. And the other one who I think obviously has improved, albeit is not having a great season, is Martial. I thought he was actually very good last season. So yeah, there were a couple of positives. I mean, I think overall you have to come away from that game and say it wasn't great quality. I mean, I thought the first half hour in particular was really scrappy. I thought De Bruyne was as bad as I've seen him for a long time. Just his touch seemed to completely desert him. And I was surprised to see him completely out-sprinted by Shaw for the second goal, as Adam described so well. So it was a strange performance. But, I mean, to go back to a question you asked earlier, Jim, I thought City actually came back into it quite well, and Guardiola changed his approach because the whole way they're playing at the moment is obviously very narrow. Cancelo's coming inside. Zinchenko pretty much does the same thing in a less dramatic way. But he made the two substitutes he made were Walker coming on for Cancelo to play as a proper overlapping fullback, and he put in a couple of really good crosses. And the other was Foden on the left, which meant that, you know, they had width on that side, someone going down the outside. And by the end, I thought actually City probably created enough chances that, I mean, if one of them had gone in, it was one of those games where you feel like Manchester United might have panicked a bit. So, I mean, people seem to, the instant reaction I saw, people were being incredibly harsh on City. But, I mean, they've won, 20 games on the trot or whatever, and launched, I thought, a pretty good comeback here. So, yeah, I wouldn't be too harsh on them.
Is this a result that, do you think, will mean something long term, or will it be, looking back, an anomaly in the same way that United's last win away at the Etihad was, and then they went on to kind of lose to whoever they lost to?
I guess Solskjaer will sell it as a result for next season. You know, in so much as he has already given up the league, so that was an acceptance, deliberate or otherwise, that this game didn't really matter to Manchester United's season, other than maybe building forward for next season. But, you know, to kind of end where we started, these have never been the problem games for Solskjaer. This isn't where he's going to prove that, unfortunately. It's brilliant beating the best teams, and normally these are the places where managers kind of earn their spurs. But it feels like the opposite with Solskjaer. It isn't going to be these games that he proves himself, because that's why he got the job on a permanent basis anyway, largely due to big game performance.
I mean, I think the significance might be in terms of the future fixtures between these two sides, because I think now we can say it's not a freak run that Solskjaer is getting the better of Guardiola. It does seem to be something tactically he's doing very well. And for all the talk about Guardiola quote, overthinking in big games, actually didn't here. I mean, he used his default system that he's been playing for the last 2 months. You wonder whether next time he comes across Manchester United, he'll make sure that there's a surprise in store for Solskjaer. Because like I say, I think Solskjaer planned for this game and the tactics worked really well in the first half. So, yeah, maybe there is some long-term significance in this particular game.
All right. Well, it was a good day for United on Sunday. Earlier in the afternoon, Liverpool continuing their collapse, this time with a defeat to Fulham at Anfield. That's a sixth consecutive loss at home. Duncan Alexander helpfully listing teams that have scored as many or more league goals than Liverpool in their own stadium in 2021 at Anfield. Man City, Everton, Chelsea, Fulham, Brighton and Burnley. Woo! Benji Lanyardo quick to write in and say, Liverpool will be the story, but this Fulham side are great. Says Benji, Parker has built a team with a bit of everything. Robustness, Tosin and Anderson. Flair, Lookman. Graft, Reed, he's fantastic. Strength, Ruben Loftus-Cheek. Pace, Aina and Cavalero. So much more worthy of the Premier League than, say, Newcastle, says Benji, earning himself a lot of fans in the northeast. Right. What did you make of Fulham, Adam?
My first thought when I saw their team, as many people pointed out, was it's actually quite an attacking lineup. And my first thought when I saw that team was that they're going to ask Parker in his pre-match interview, they're going to ask him, is this a good time to be playing Liverpool? And he'll play it down. But then having seen that team, I thought, do you know what? Secretly, and perhaps not so secretly, he's thought, yeah, it is a bloody good time to be playing Liverpool and I'm going to chuck everything at them. And it was quite nice to see a manager fairly obviously doing that. It was a nice little cross-section of a club in crisis, this game. So Fulham did arrive at perhaps just the right time. But, I mean, there was a dreaded plane banner going over Anfield, which is quite literally never a good sign. Liverpool's back four was sort of actually quite sad to look at. Nat Phillips and Reece Williams is the most unexpected centre-half partnership for a big club since Jose Mourinho took Michael Essien and Paulo Ferreira to Anfield to play against Rafa Benitez's Liverpool in 2007. And the only thing that went against Fulham today was Scott Parker's touchline outfit, which I thought was abysmal.
Right.
Absolutely abysmal.
How would you characterise it? World's least subtle shoplifter or shy man on his way to a game of strip poker? I'd go with the latter myself.
It looked to me like a kind of post-rapid diet Michelin man.
Okay.
Kind of... look, yeah.
Well, he, you know, the temperatures were what they were. you know, his on-field outfit is doing a great job. So,
yes. Yeah,
we salute you, Cottagers. Only Man City, I heard in commentary, have allowed fewer goals since the start of December. That's extraordinary.
I mean, they are, on the basis of the past 2 or 3 months, they look a really good side for them. I mean, there's been quite a few games where they've only drawn and they have had, well, the collected too many draws, but there's a few games where they really could have won them. And I agree. I think what Benji says is spot on. I mean, I think that there's a couple of quite obvious characteristics about the side that work really well here, particularly playing combinations on the counter to get Lookman in down the left. And it just felt so often that ball throughout the first half was on for them. I mean, they're a funny side. We talk about Manchester United being, you know, better in the big games. I mean, Fulham have won 5 games this season and 3 of them have been away at the top 7 in the league. They've won away at Leicester, won away at Everton. Now they've won away at Liverpool. So, I mean, they are quite a strange side as well. But, yeah, on the basis of their form and their current level of performance, they are on course to stay up, which I don't think any of us would have vaguely imagined in October when they just look completely out of their depth.
Right. In December, Matt Davis-Adams points out, he tipped Fulham to stay up. Matt Davis-Adams, of course, famously tipping Bournemouth to do the opposite last season. He says that he said Fulham would stay up, and that was back in December. They would be out of the bottom three right now had they not been controversially denied an equaliser in a game that took place after our last show Thursday night against Spurs over that handball by Mario Lemina in the build-up to what would have been Josh Marge's goal. Lemina, by the way, Adam, the way he got the better of Mo Salah for Fulham's goal... I've heard it described in many different ways, some less broadcastable than others. How would you describe it?
Well, from a kind of scoreline perspective, some may regard it as an opener, which is just before half time is a very grey area. I mean, how late can you go with opener? I've seen it in the 88th minute people describing goals as openers. It's just scratching the surface of the current vandalism of the language of football that is currently happening.
Right. What about the actual act of just muscling him out the way, of beasting him?
Not a huge fan of the verb to beast.
No.
I have to say.
So Salah's just a bit casual when he receives the ball and Lamina just comes past him, I think kind of half jujitsu's him out the way and says, I'll be having that. I mean, he certainly puts an arm across to kind of lever him out.
I had a horrible feeling for a while that VAR was going to look at it and Lamina was going to shed actual tears on the pitch after Thursday night, yeah.
Mm, indeed. Anyway, they kept the goal. They earned themselves a win. They are now level with Brighton. Brighton just outside the bottom three with their goal difference. Somehow, I don't know how Brighton have a better goal difference, but anyway, Newcastle are 1 point better off after their 0-0 at West Brom, and Burnley are 4 points ahead. But basically, you've got four teams there within 4 points, so could be pretty tasty that relegation scrap. Brighton and Newcastle do have a game in hand. Meanwhile, Liverpool, though, without a goal from open play at home in, I think it's 708 minutes now. Well, anyway, since December the 27th. Mark Ogden tweeting, I'm running out of words to describe this. It's gone from a blip to a slump to a malaise to a meltdown. Now what? Adam, you're perfectly placed to help Mark with his quandary.
He's got the hierarchy just about right there, I'd say. We're definitely into cracked badge territory. But what I would say is this isn't your usual crisis. There isn't an evidently poisonous dressing room. There's no manager at loggerheads with the boardroom and no so tableaus of despair on the pitch either. But we are definitely into crack badge territory. That is the most crucial thing. But what the most worrying thing perhaps of the whole day for Liverpool's perspective was that after the game, Jurgen Klopp was asked what his priority was. And he says, my priority is just to win football games. And that is what managers in crisis say. That's exactly the phrase that crisis managers use. When they start saying football games in full, you know things are bad.
Yeah, the odd thing to me with Liverpool is just how broken everything looks. They're obviously fighting, but normally when a team's in crisis, there's a kind of desperation to everything they do. You didn't even really get that today. It looked like almost like they were just kind of going through the motions to try and score. And yeah, when they were really good, it felt like kind of fate was on their side and they wrestled the narrative back in the last 5 minutes of games and scored crucial goals at crucial times. And now it all just feels a bit flat, which is worse, I think, than the anger. You know, if there was a real anger to it, then at least it would be, as Adam says, diagnosable. But it's kind of hard to, other than the injuries, but even with the injuries, you'd still think there'd be a bit more fight to it. And there's just not.
Well, the next football game that their manager will be focused on winning for Liverpool is, of course, RB Leipzig in the Champions League. And look, we're joined now by Raphael Honigstein. Hello, Rafa.
Hello, James.
Hello there. Crikey, RB Leipzig. I imagine they're looking at this tie, RB, with renewed optimism. It looked a bit over, but maybe not.
Yes, I think you might be right, although they had quite a bit of optimism going into the first leg, and a lot of people in Germany are saying, well, Liverpool are obviously not playing well and Leipzig are flying. This is going to be not easy, but a lot of people made Leipzig favourites. So I think they're a bit more cautious now. But of course, they had a great win at the weekend, 3-0 against Freiburg in Freiburg, which is a proverbial tough place to go in Bundesliga standards. And I don't have to tell you what Liverpool did in the meantime. So yes, I think maybe a sense that it's not quite over yet. Although the bad news, of course, is that Liverpool could afford to lose this game, this being the home leg. A 1-0 would still be fine, 1-0 defeat. So, but yeah, should be really interesting.
Okay, Leipzig in a terrific run of form in the last 9 games. The only one they haven't won was the 2-0 home in inverted commas game against Liverpool in the Champions League. Since that defeat, they've had 4 wins, scoring 11, only conceding 2. And as I recall, back in the group stage as well, they really messed up the first time against, well, at least in terms of the result, against Man United at Old Trafford. But then in the second meeting, had the better of them. So possibly there's a sense that Nagelsmann acquires the knowledge to then beat his opponents.
Yeah, I mean, they don't tend to have too many bad games in a row. So I think there's an opportunity for them. Where I'm slightly less optimistic is when it comes to creating chances at this level. They seem to be working a lot harder than maybe some of other clubs who have big, very reliable centre forwards or forward players. Leipzig rely a lot on their midfielders. Sometimes they don't even have a striker on the pitch. And I think it's a tactic that I wouldn't say has worked against them, because Nagelsmann made the most out of it. But it also, I think, shows you that in maybe those slightly edgier games, when they're up against teams with just a bit more up front, they tend to struggle. But yeah, it's definitely a very good opportunity. I mean, you wouldn't think that Liverpool would possibly be having such a bad spell. And I totally agree with you that this is probably one of the better times playing against them. And I think as much as Nagelsmann will try not to sort of agree with this publicly, I'm sure that deep down he will be plotting ways of exploiting that.
Right, okay. And presumably a big push for an early goal will be key to that for Leipzig, will it? From the first game between the two sides, was there any elements that may make you think that it is a reversible thing for RB Rasenball?
Rasenballsport. Yeah, I think so. I think what was quite noticeable, at least from my perspective, was that I think a lot of people who perhaps hadn't seen that much of RB came away thinking, well, what's the fuss about? You know, they look quite ordinary. And, you know, what is the big deal here? But I think that was really a reflection on Liverpool playing very well on the night and restricting Leipzig to almost no chances. Liverpool didn't have that many chances either, so it was quite edgy. So, you know, if Liverpool perhaps are not quite as good as they were in that game, and if Leipzig just can up it a little bit, then a 2-0 deficit, I think, could turn into a 2-0 win. But, of course, then would still then need another goal. So it's not going to be more straightforward of missions for them, simply because the first result is so bad.
Okay. Rafa, just before you go, comparisons which get increasingly mentioned with Dortmund's slump in late period Klopp there. Is it fair to say they're getting more and more relevant to what's going on at Liverpool?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's getting more relevant because the results don't seem to be getting any better, and a lot of people couldn't quite understand, I guess Klopp included, why Dortmund had such a terrible first half of the season in 14-15, the season he left. I guess the real relevance would only become apparent if we'd be somehow in a situation where Klopp himself feels that he has to go, which of course happened in that season. I don't think we've reached that point yet. I think the backing inside the club is a lot stronger than it was within Dortmund in 14-15. Liverpool are not in danger of relegation yet. I think Dortmund were, at least for half the season. And, you know, bouncing back for Dortmund meant finishing in seventh. Bouncing back for Liverpool would probably mean finishing in fourth, or maybe winning the Champions League, or at least having a good run. So I think there is still not quite the same level of crisis being reached. But of course, the results have been bad. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult for Liverpool to explain exactly why things have gone so wrong so quickly, with allowing for all the issues that we know about. It still is hard to explain why they've been so bad recently.
Mm, but the Dortmund example doesn't give us any clues to that. And equally, what enabled them to turn it around? And is that in any way applicable to the situation at Liverpool?
This is where I'm a little bit worried, because what turned it around for Dortmund, having a bit of a break over Christmas, having time to go back on the training ground and working on a lot of details that for one reason or the other just had stopped working. Once they got these details right, they were once again the second best team by quite a distance in the league. And it was quite interesting, because Liverpool themselves looked into that slump when they were thinking about Jurgen Klopp a little bit later, And their analytics department figured out that even at their very worst, actually, a lot of it could be explained by bad luck. In other words, even when they were the worst team in the Bundesliga results-wise, they were just on a rotten run when a lot of things went against them. But I feel that this ability to just kind of switch off or maybe take the team to Marbella for 10 days, all the sort of things that you would do in a normal season right now, they're not available, which I think makes this all a little bit more complicated than it might have to be in ordinary times.
All right, Rafa. Well, big game coming up then on Wednesday night for the embattled Liverpool manager. You'll be back in Tuesday's Totally Football Show, previewing that a little bit more and also telling us all about that extraordinary De Clasico comeback by Bayern. So I look forward to speaking to you then.
Me too, James. Bye.
Pep, what do you think of the risks of players taking part in fantasy football?
I think that fantasy football? What is this fantasy football?
And Man City win the treble again with an incredible goal for Erling Haaland, who's just signed a 10-year contract with Man City. He said what sealed it was the long flowing locks of manager Pep Guardiola. Look at him there on the sidelines, his hair cascading down over his shoulders.
Oh. Next question?
That's one sort of fantasy football, Pep. Paddy Power.
18+ BGAMBLERAware.org.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Sunday night, Spurs are walloping Crystal Palace 4-1, continuing their recent rampaging form. That's four straight wins for Mourinho's side. They've scored 12 goals in those games, only conceded two. They are now sixth, 2 points off the top four. Now, Michael, you didn't see this game too much, so Adam and Daniel, can you tell Michael all about the spectacle that he missed?
Yeah, sure. Well, this was yet another kind of chapter in the resurgence of Gareth Bale, or at least nominally. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, he clearly isn't the player he used to be. But I do fear, though, that I mean, he's going to comfortably hit double figures for Spurs this season. And then you look back and he scored his goals against the likes of Brighton, Lask, Stoke, Wickham, Wolfsberger, Burnley and now Palace. But then on the other hand, I think that's who Spurs play 70% of the time. So who cares? But it's minutes under his belt, because that was what he clearly needed. He needed a run of games, and then that was going to provide the answer to whether he was either washed up or there was something still there. And I think this is money in the bank for the kind of latter perspective. But the highlight for me was the third goal by Harry Kane, which was just so nice. I mean, we're so used to kind of the classic Harry Kane goal, which is turning centre of goal 25 yards out and just larruping it into the kind of bottom left. But this was Kane that's slightly more subtle, which was kind of letting the ball do the work as he hit it first time, receiving it from the right, curling it into the top left corner, which is always such a nice goal to see. And you know what they're trying to do. And even by extension, the goalkeeper knows what's about to happen and can't do anything about it. So you add all those things up and you get a very, very nice goal. So any Spurs performance that contains a Kane goal like that is all right by me.
Right. So before this, Bale had opened the scoring, and then Christian Benteke had equalised for Palace to the delight of Roy Keane, who kind of opined for some time about how much he liked headed goals. He and Souness had a bit of a reminisce about that. And then Bale scored again, and then came this remarkable Kane goal. And I'm surprised, Sam, you say that the goalkeeper knew what was happening, because it caught me completely by surprise. The speed at which Kane addressed that ball and yeah, it was remarkable for such a difficult shot.
I can't speak to the goalkeeper's eye line, but it was classic technique. You knew where Kane was going. It's just that the trajectory is always going to take the ball away from the keeper. But I feel like I should step in on the Benteke subject, it was widely described as a bullet header, which is a shameful description of what went on in front of everybody's eyes. What's wrong with people?
Why was it not? What would it need to be a bullet header?
I mean, it was somewhere between a glancing header and a bullet header. So it was on that spectrum, but absolutely nowhere near enough. I mean, bullet headers need to be essentially coming straight back off your head,
right,
forcefully towards the goal, and you sort of using the direction of the delivery of the cross. Thinking, so maybe sort of Hullet's headed goal for Holland in the final of Euro 88 as my go-to example for this sort of thing. But it just wasn't a bullet header. That's not a bullet header, surely. Quite right.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. So
proud of himself there.
Gareth, rightly so. Gareth, don't know why I didn't see it.
Yeah.
Gareth Bale with 6 goals and 6 now. That's a lot. And you say they're against teams that et cetera and so on, but he could maybe add a more illustrious opponent to that tally next weekend when they play Arsenal. Gareth Bale, stats say, and now has more goals in the league in a week for Spurs than he scored in 18 months for Real Madrid. Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't caught up with this game yet, but I did see the pre-match team sheet and noticed that Tottenham came incredibly close to naming 1 to 11 shirt numbers. They named 10 of the 11, and then Lucas Moura was in instead of Eric Lamella. Had Eric Lamella played instead of Lucas, it would have been the first time since 98-99 in Charlton Athletic that a team had fielded 1 to 11 shirt numbers from the start in a Premier League game. So if you like that sort of thing, there's your information.
Wow. Okay. Spurs against Arsenal next week, and I think by now we have to assume that this kind of approach will continue from Tottenham Hotspur. Arsenal, meantime, Saturday, they were at Burnley, and fans often talk about a club's DNA, West Ham fans, Liverpool. This was very much Arsenal's DNA, this game.
Yeah, I couldn't quite decide whether they were going to get bullied by Burnley on set pieces or were going to make a defensive ricket to cede control in a game they should have been leading by 2 or 3. And they went with option B this time, so fair play to them for mixing it up.
Right. So they'd scored a rather lovely opener from Aubameyang, mm-hmm. although Nick Pope may have felt that he should have dealt with it a bit better. But anyway, so they're in the lead and... Well, do you want to describe what happened to anyone who missed it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just Arsenal playing out from the back, which I should say, you know, you hear commentators say quite a lot, kind of, oh, they'll get themselves into trouble doing this, and then kind of almost crowing when it happens. I mean, Arsenal are better at playing out from the back than they would be if they just launched it long and ceded possession every time they did it against Burnley's back four, who are more than happy to deal with that. So I think they did the right thing. They just kind of stuffed it up. And yeah, Chris Wood got in the way of passer and passy. And there was a controversy, obviously, about penalties, etc. But I don't think Arsenal really justified the win.
Oh, OK. So yeah, Xhaka just basically... smacked the ball straight at Chris Wood and it bounced off into the goal, which was remarkable.
It's a good trick shot, yeah.
I like to think of it as a kind of an acceptable waste product of this new style of play, because I think teams kind of budget for one or two of these a season, knowing full well that in the grand scheme of it, this style of play is going to work out. So if anything, it's kind of, we all take something from it. Teams, as I say, kind of budget for these kind of, you know, errant situations, and the rest of us just get to enjoy it once or twice a season, right. times 20. So I think we all win from this.
I think it's worth pointing out as well that the first goal that Arsenal scored, or the only goal Arsenal scored, did come from very brave passing in deep positions from Xhaka, and in particular Partey, playing through the lines. And I mean, Arsenal were trying to do that. They were deliberately trying to prompt Burnley to press up high and then play past them. And I thought by and large it worked quite well. Yeah, obviously, I agree with Adam. I think it's built into the way Arteta wants to play. And I think overall, since he took over, I think Arsenal have scored some fantastic goals playing out from the back. So, yeah, for me, it was another individual error from Xhaka.
Yeah, it certainly seems to be built into the way he wants to play. as per the penalties that Daniel wanted to gloss over, so the one was an Eric Peters handball, which wasn't given. And that's the one that Arsenal were upset about. And there was another one later on that was given and he was going to be sent off, but then VAR overturned it, which means that this stat is still true. No Burnley players have been sent off in a home Premier League game since 2009. Remarkable. That's 130 matches now, I think, now at Turf Moor. Burnley are now 1-9 Premier League games, and with the point possibly is some use to them as they continue to hover on the edge of the relegation scrap. As for Arsenal, I'm not sure what they're intending to do with their league campaign at this point. They've gone with 2 wins in the last 7, 8 games without a clean sheet. And yeah, this new look Spurs arriving next week. It's, yeah, interesting times. And Olympiacos coming up on Thursday.
Yeah, I was really surprised to learn about the clean sheet thing that you just said, because Arsenal have actually got a really good defensive record. I mean, they've conceded fourth fewest goals in the league, only behind Man City, Chelsea and Aston Villa. So there seem to be so many statistical quirks about this Premier League campaign. It's just been a very strange campaign. I think Arsenal are one of the strangest teams in it.
Mm. Already. Do you see any sign, Michael, of them coalescing into something less strange?
Yeah, I mean, Arteta must be tearing his hair out, because this was another game where I thought, by and large, Arsenal did the right things. I mean, they had one blocked on the line, they had one off the post. I mean, there's been quite a few games like this where they should have won it. And I think when they don't win, it has often been down to the players rather than Arteta's strategy. And if you like the underlying numbers and that kind of thing, there's been a major improvement since November, December, where things were looking really dodgy. So, yeah, I do see an improvement. I just think they're probably maybe a couple of players away and a bit more, you know, familiarity with the system to start challenging for the European places. But, yeah, I mean, that said, for them to be in 10th is quite an underachievement, isn't it? And you wonder whether, I mean, they're out of the FA Cup, but you wonder whether Europa League might rescue Arteta's campaign the same way the FA Cup did last year.
Let's not forget the Europa Conference League, which I think is taking us back to what the true European places used to be. Like, when I think back to the phrase European places, it used to be kind of a nice little chunk of the league table where you could hope to finish. Now it's down to kind of like one Europa League place. But it's quite feasible that a team like Liverpool could find themselves in a qualifying for the Europa Conference League next season. Or, in fact, if Arsenal buck their ideas up, they could find themselves there. But I did see an incredible headline this week that suggested that Liverpool were in danger of qualifying for the Europa Conference League, which I have never seen that phrase used, which says all that needs to be said about the attitude towards that new competition.
By the way, listener, if you were thinking when Michael said that Arteta tearing his hair out that he must need incredibly strong wrists, then you're not the only one. Brighton, similarly on brand in terms of their DNA with their clash with Leicester, in that they performed well and took the lead on Saturday, but came away with nothing. A 2-1 victory for Leicester at the Amex, featuring Adam Lallana's first goal for Brighton, which gave them the early lead, and then another lovely goal from Iheanacho, and then that business with the goalkeeper Roberto Sanchez and Daniel Amati blow.
Oh, yeah, just a word on Iheanacho, who I'm kind of inclined to believe just doesn't fit Leicester, or probably just isn't quite good enough for what they want to achieve. But he's got them 4 points in the last week or so. And Jamie Vardy on the quiet has only scored once in his last 14 games for Leicester, which means they really needed Iheanacho. And credit to Rodgers, who's kind of gone to a two up front, which I guess was just to try and push Iheanacho up there and give Vardy a bit more room and kind of take a defender away from Vardy. But actually, it's led to Iheanacho scoring a few goals rather than Vardy, which is a kind of happy, you know, a happy end result for Leicester, because, yeah, with the injuries they've got, every win's golden at the moment.
Iheanacho's goal was a really, really nice finish. Again, a finish you don't really see that often, like that level of calmness and timing. He kind of sort of half fakes the goalkeeper and then produced a finish that nobody was expecting. I just really, really like that finish. And a little note on Vardy as well. We're so used to him kind of streaming over the top for through balls, but it's got to the point now where when you watch him sprint, you're waiting for him to pull up. It looks really painful. Like and we know he's basically either carrying an injury or he's kind of not long after a hernia operation. And I start to think we are seeing the kind of last dregs of Jamie Vardy. Because the one thing about him is that he's never going to become any other type of player. You're not going to see him drop into the kind of centre midfield spraying passes around. So that's it. That's all the Vardy we're ever going to get.
Crikey. That's a bit of a thought. On a more kind of heartwarming note, nice to see Marcy returning after 2 years out injured and getting the winner in this game. A last gasp winner, I think we can call it that. Yeah, Adam, there's no...
88 minutes, it's close to the edge.
Would you say?
Specialists in the field do recommend 88 onwards. No, sorry, 89 onwards.
Okay.
So you're into the last minute of regular time and then injury time notwithstanding. It's the real issue with last gasp is when people start using it for sort of the fifth goal in like a 5-0 win. So,
right.
You know, last gasp, fifth goal, which is clearly against the very definition of it. It's not desperate. That's cake icing.
It has to change, fundamentally change the outcome of the game.
It probably would do because it's either an equaliser or a winner. But
right,
it's the point, by definition, it's a desperate act. It was done in desperate times.
Absolutely.
I thought the winner was interesting because when I was on this podcast a few weeks ago after the Brighton-Burnley game, I said that Burnley were just peppering Robert Sanchez with crosses as if Dyche had thought, well, here's a Spanish guy. He won't be able to cope with crosses. And I wonder whether he watched this and kind of grinned to himself. And then I researched Sanchez. I say research. I looked him up on Wikipedia and found that he's actually been in England since the age of 15.
Hmm.
And so there's a potential if he... I mean, this mistake aside, I think he's been very good. So there's a potential he'll be like the new Manuel Almunia and we'll be saying, get Sanchez on the plane to the Euros or the World
Although,
Cup.
Although, because, as Adam has pointed out, I think all England's games are being played in England anyway.
Well, that might be true. maybe Qatar's is time to shine.
Right,
but he hasn't played for Spain. He's never played for any of the youth teams.
Okay.
He's now 23. So who knows what might happen with that?
But maybe the same situation could apply to Sidney Tavares. Did you enjoy his... was this his debut? He looked really exciting, though.
First start.
Hmm, okay. Cousin of Nani, the Man United winger. Anyway, first start of his senior career. I thought he looked quite lively. There you go. How much trouble are Brighton in?
The good news is they didn't have loads and loads of shots without scoring. The bad news is they had fewer shots and still contrived to miss a few of them. I'm worried about them. I tweeted earlier because I was just looking at the odds and I couldn't quite believe that there were such outsiders for relegation. Even after Fulham won, Brighton is still like 6-1 to go down and Newcastle are evens, which given that I know Newcastle have a number of problems and Brighton's underlying numbers are pretty good, but we've played 27 games and they are still behind Newcastle in the table. So that kind of constant getting so close and missing out in different ways psychologically must start to affect you at some point so that the next time you get a chance, you're less likely to take it than the last one you had. And I they have Newcastle at home, we should say, in a week's time or 10 days time, which probably helps.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Also in action this weekend were Southampton away at Bramall Lane, where they brought to an end that really dismal run of form that they'd been on with a 2-0 victory over Sheffield United. James Ward-Prowse with the early penalty. And then, Adam, can I say Che Adams got in on the act?
No, you may not.
Why not?
You may
scored.
Why not? I mean, interesting elementary logic there, but getting in the act is a very specialist thing. Getting in the act is essentially a very polite way of saying, how must you be, even this guy scored. So it's essentially either the fourth or fifth goal in a rout scored, preferably by a player who wouldn't normally be seen on the score sheet. So
but
all
it's
those
Southampton,
things combined.
So doesn't two goals count as like, you know,
no,
four or five?
No, it's
of
not relative.
Teams.
It's not okay. relative to a team's ability. It can't be shifted like that. One okay. thing I did like about this game is it marks the real kind of the point at which Chris Wilder has essentially thrown in the towel, but in a really nice way. He gave an interview before the game where it was suggested that Sheffield United might be able to kind of lay into Southampton, and he said,
"What sort of interview is this? Have you not seen the league table?" We're not exactly ripping it up, Craig, eh?
I hate to use the word refreshing, but I'm going to use it anyway. It's an incredibly refreshing way for a manager to own up to his own team's failings by making a massive joke about it before the game. And then afterwards, he was in a kind of a similar mood.
Why do you hate the word refreshing?
Because we seem to roll it out every season for a manager who says something in a slightly unique way, and I'm ashamed of myself for saying it.
Okay.
On Wilder, I don't know if this is why he's in kind of, again, in kind of D-mob happy mode, but there are reports that there's this kind of breakdown of relationship between owners and him, in so much as they'd quite like a director of football and point to the fact they spent £80 million on five players in the last year and a half that have not done particularly well. And he would like full control, which... I mean, I guess is a kind of natural end if they go down, in that everyone will still be grateful, but accept that maybe someone else might do a decent job bringing them back up, because it's a heck of a job to turn around the mood at that club, the same guy, I think, over the course of a summer.
Meanwhile, Southampton marking what was Ralph Hasenhüttl's 100th game in charge with this victory. So that's nice. A couple of goalless draws, but we don't need to talk about those, Michael. So Aston Villa Wolves 0-0. No one could break the deadlock. That's fair, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah. Agreed.
And the West Brom Newcastle one, a great stat this from Daniel Storey. From a Newcastle point of view, Jeff Hendrick is the Magpies' top league goal scorer in the starting 11 in this game. He's only had one shot on target since the opening weekend. How is he?
So he scored on the opening weekend and then scored with his only other shot on target against Leeds.
So he, with two goals, was the highest scoring player in that starting 11.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
And if I can be so bold to say it, the match very much kind of moved on from that statistic and rode with it, because it was pretty desperate fare. Bruce kind of described it afterwards. He sort of said, "Oh, this is a good point." Which seemed, at the time, seemed a really strange thing to say, with Fulham about to kick off 10 minutes later, because it immediately was proven not a particularly good point, because they were playing their easiest away game remaining this season, and Fulham won at Liverpool. So, yeah, he also kind of said with a resigned air, kind of, "We've done okay this season," as if he was just sort of hoping that no one would challenge him on it, which I really liked. And no one really did, in their defence. They just sort of went, "Yeah, let's move on."
Well, still to come from this Premier League round, there are two games on Monday. Michael, you've got big issues with the scheduling of these, yes?
I wouldn't say big issues, just surprised. I mean, usually the Monday 6 p.m. game is one you can kind of write off, because it usually involves West Brom or Burnley. But I think Chelsea and Everton were like fourth versus fifth coming into the weekend.
Right, yeah, it's Chelsea against Everton, 6 o'clock. It might have kicked off, listen. I don't know what time it is for you right now. But yeah. That's 6 o'clock on Monday. Thursday, of course, after our most recent Totally Show, Chelsea were long ball winners over Liverpool. Thomas Tuchel continuing his excellent run of results. He's unbeaten in 10 games as Chelsea manager. Only two goals conceded. And that big question, "Yeah, but who's he beaten?" has now been rather resoundingly answered. Two of last year's Champions League last 16, in fact, Atletico Madrid and Liverpool most recently. So... all looking good. Thumbs up all round for Thomas?
Yeah, I think there's still a question about the attacking side of it, in that it feels like a formation designed to make Chelsea really disciplined and hard to break down, which is exactly what they needed to be. But I think he would probably have liked more, kind of better in that transition, in the passing through midfield. It sometimes feels like it gets a little bit clogged or a little bit laboured there, unless they have that special move where Mount kind of hangs out on the right and him and Hudson-Odoi double up on the left back. That works really well. But that kind of feels like their only or their best passage of attacking play. But yeah, obviously it's going well.
Mm. Everton, by the way, haven't won at Stamford Bridge for over 26 years. Crikey. Although they have won the last three meetings with Chelsea at Goodison Park. Interesting. West Ham Leeds will be slightly later on Monday. 8 o'clock, that one kicks off. I believe that this is quite a cherished fixture amongst... Well, fans of red cards, principally. West Ham once ended this fixture with eight men back in May 1999. They'd lost 5-1 at Upton Park against Leeds. The three players sent off for the Hammers were Steve Lomas, Shaka Hislop and Ian Wright, who actually was the first to go after only 13 minutes. And the reason that I mentioned this is quite a cherished memory was that this is the time when he basically went into the referee's dressing room. Rob Harris was the official and took his clothes and threw them in the bath.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
It does feel like a very red cardy game, like in any era.
Yeah.
I mean, you've basically got two sort of mildly hysterical football clubs with similar fan bases. But crucially, it's a game that in any decade of the Premier League's existence, I would be quite up for watching, let alone at 8 p.m. on a Monday.
8 o'clock. But that might clash with the big... When's the big interview on Monday? The Meghan...
No idea.
Really? All right.
No idea.
Okay.
My theory is that Adam thinks it's red cardy because it's West Ham Leeds screams Lee Bowyer to me.
Yes, that's exactly what I had in mind.
All right then. Well, whatever you choose to watch, hope you enjoy it on Monday night. Still to come in this edition of the Totally Football Show, all sorts of stuff. We'll mention Rangers, that's for sure. But first of all, something pretty special, because we're about to hear for the last time on this show, certainly as the man from Paddy Power, from Lee Price. Over to you, old friend.
Hello, listener, for the final time. Yep, this is my last Paddy Power segment. Thank you for listening through the dad jokes, the bad jokes, the singing, and indeed the odds. There'll be none of those things today, but plenty of the usual self-indulgence, you'll be glad to hear. Personally, I have to say, it's been a genuine thrill to be associated with this show. I've listened for many years. I remember watching the recording of one episode live as a wide-eyed work experience kid at a certain newspaper, probably about a decade ago, depressingly. But seeing producer Ben and AC Jimbo in full flow was magic. I'll continue to be a listener, and maybe I won't have to skip the sponsor segment anymore, now they got rid of that annoying guy. And it might even be safe to go back to my Twitter mentions. Maybe. Your job now is to stand by the new manager of this segment. I'll leave you with the words of Britain's finest poets. Fever forever. I'll be waiting. Everlasting like the sun. Hasta mañana.
Happy trails, Lee. You can find odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Hey, listener, while you're here, why not sign up for a subscription with The Athletic, which will provide you with unrivaled coverage on what I think I can call the business end of the season. Adam, have we started? Are we at the business end yet or not?
Some people are quite lenient with this and say it's Christmas onwards.
What?
That's probably pushing it. My theory is that it should be Easter, for the simple reason that nobody knows when Easter is. Right. So it's fine.
Whenever the business end comes around, you'll get unrivaled coverage of it on or at The Athletic. All the articles, all the podcasts, ad-free, and Q&As with writers, and the odd quiz as well. All of that for the extraordinarily low price of just £4 a month. You can find this deal at theathletic.com/totally. Rangers are champions, everybody. There was a big party, Stevie G. Now, was this a reference to "This Does Not Slip"? Because surely not. Do you know? Because basically, in the party in the dressing room afterwards, they kind of prepare a kind of slightly kind of moistened bit of floor, and he does a slide across the dressing room floor in his work clothes.
Everything that he said, fair enough if it is, but everything he said afterwards has made that him sound a genuine shell of a man talking about that incident. So, I mean, maybe this was his kind of complete absolution of
probably
it by
not. Probably
recreating
not.
It, but I would be surprised.
I think dressing room sliding is very much the en vogue way of celebrating big wins.
Is it? Okay. All right.
Yes. Usually kit men, but, you know, fair enough.
Well, it was nice that he mucked in and, you know, there was much rejoicing. There's a special Beyond the Headline podcast all about Rangers' triumph, and that's due out, I think, this week. Look out for that one, telling the story of how they took the title back from Celtic. Hopefully soundtrack with, I don't know, In the Air Tonight, maybe, or In Too Deep, something like that. Rangers' triumph will also get a mention in the Totally Scottish Football Show, which is out this Tuesday. Tuesday is the day to look out for the Offside Rule WSL edition as well. A Totally Football League show, hope you're keeping up with this, is out on Monday. Ooh, Swansea, winners in midweek with a 96th-minute penalty from Andre Ayew. Guess what happened this Saturday? They won with a 97th-minute penalty from Andre Ayew. That is last gasp, isn't it?
That is the lastest of gaspists.
Right. Excellent. What did Forrest do this weekend? Daniel?
Don't worry about that.
And on Tuesday, you can catch up with Rafa and the boys in the Totally Football Show European Edition. Crikey, there's a lot of things we're going to be talking about there. Obviously, we're looking forward to the Europa League games on Thursday and the midweek Champions League second legs. We'll also be discussing Der Klassiker and the election. They finally had the election at Barcelona and loads of other stuff too. So make sure you join us for that. There's a new Golazzo out as well, by the way, featuring Raphael Honigstein, all about the Tre Tedeschi, the three Germans at Inter, Matthäus, Bremer and Klinsmann. So do hope you enjoy that. And next week we'll bring a fresh Golazzo, which is all about Ronaldo. No, not that one. That one. Good. Excellent. Michael, what are you going to be up to this week?
Staying in my house and watching football, I suppose. Right. Okay. I don't really think about plans for the upcoming week anymore.
No, that's the beauty of it. Come May, you'll have to think about plans again. But for now, the only thing you have to plan is which game you're most excited about watching. What are you going to watch? Give us one game.
If we're including Monday night, I think Chelsea-Everton could be quite fun. So I'll go for that.
Tuesday night, what are you going to watch, Daniel?
Dortmund-Sevilla on Tuesday, I'd have thought. And, yeah, Liverpool on Wednesday. Liverpool is obviously really interesting because if they can see the first goal, that becomes a real thing, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, though? Yeah. And Adam, what's ringed in red for you?
I will be choosing some new paving stones for my back garden.
Seriously?
Yes. It looks like Indian sandstone, but we're not entirely decided. Equally undecided about my Wednesday night choice. I'm tempted by Liverpool-Leipzig just to see if there would be any more capitulation, but I still also want to see the final humiliation that is PSG-Barcelona. Yes.
I can understand that. If you're in doubt, listener, yourself, then listen to Tuesday's Totally Football Show European edition when we'll be breaking down those fixtures and you can take an informed view for your evening's viewing pleasure. That, though, brings us to the end of today's Totally Football Show. So I do hope you have a splendid rest of your day. And many thanks to Daniel and Adam and Michael for being with us and Charlie for staying up through the night and putting it all together and you, listener, for putting up with us all the way through. We'll be back soon. From all of us here in the meantime, though, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of the Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.